This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. This weekend saw news about renewed pressure on Israel to make a deal with the Palestinians to create a separate Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. It's the kind of deal that's been talked about for years but never realized. Coming up later, we'll talk with Greg Myrie and Jennifer Griffin, a husband and wife journalism team who covered the conflict for years. Their book is called This Burning Land. But first, Dr. Izzeldin Abolish, who was born into adversity in a Palestinian refugee camp. He became a well-known physician in Gaza who treated patients on both sides of the border. In 2009, an Israeli rocket hit his house, killing three of his daughters and his niece. He's now an associate professor of medicine at the School of Public Health at the University of Toronto in Canada, and he's author of the book, I Shall Not Hate. He's urging reconciliation, not more violence. He joined us last week in studio when he was here to talk at Central Connecticut State University. Dr. Izzeldin Abolish, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you.
First of all, I want you to tell us about growing up in a Palestinian refugee camp and growing up where you did and how you turned it into a career in medicine. Tell us about growing up.
I was born and raised in a Jabalia refugee camp in the Gaza Strip to a family which was kicked out from their homeland in 1948 after the Palestinian crisis. And this is one of the most difficult times in life for anyone. When you feel homeless, stateless, in one day or night, to be nothing. But our parents, they were determined, they realized the importance of education. And as a child, to be in a refugee camp with the full meaning of suffering, deprived of childhood, abject poverty, deprivation, where children in a time they are born to taste their childhood. The Palestinian children in the refugee camps, they never tasted their childhood. And I was one of them. But it's shame even till now. Hundreds of millions of children suffer the same. Nothing changed. This suffering is man-made. We were not born with it. It's what did we do to each other and we practice. And I can say to you, in that I looked as a hope, because it's man-made.
It's man-made, but have you ever said that one group of men or the other is to blame? Do you blame some group of men for that man-made tragedy?
I don't like to blame. Blaming is not the right way. The right approach is to take responsibility. What can you do in a positive way to challenge and to change what is going on? Not to witness or watch it in silence. What can you do? That's important. Because if we want to start blaming, we will never move forward. For me, as a medical doctor now, if a patient comes and I wanted to blame that patient. Why he is not taking the medication? Why he is not following my orders? I will never move. I want to deal with the case and to see why he didn't follow the instructions. We are not punishing or blaming. We care about each other. And that's important in a positive way. So I dreamed, and I can tell everyone, dream big. It's important to dream. I can oppress someone. I can occupy. I can deprive him. I can imprison him. But no one can deprive us or prevent us from dreaming. Dreams are free for everyone. So dream big. The young men and women in this world, they have to dream. Dreams are close to reality. Once they are accompanied by hard work. I dreamed one day to be a medical doctor. I succeeded. I worked hard. And now I achieved that dream.
In Gaza today, are those dreams hard to come by for young people, do you think?
I don't think. Nothing is impossible. Even in spite of the difficulty, the Palestinians in general and the Gazans in particular are living. They are dreaming and they are achieving their dreams. Nothing is impossible. And I can say to you, my daughter, Shada, who was severely wounded, that I am proud of. She lost the sight in one eye. She lost two fingers. And what did she suffer in 1 year? Mountains. Can't bear that. She went back to the high school to study, to work hard. Determined, because she was working hard to be one of the first 10 in Palestine, in the high school. After what did she suffer? I didn't expect anything from her. She did the exam, and she succeeded. As nothing happened, as usual, she succeeded 96%. And now what is she doing? She's studying computer engineering at the University of Toronto. Give them the freedom. Our people and the children who are the future, they have the potential. So give them the opportunity and you will see what can they do.
I know that you've had to tell this story many, many times, and some in our listening audience have probably heard your story and some haven't. So I'm wondering if you can take us back to the day that Israeli bombs essentially wrecked your life, destroyed your life, and killed members of your family. Could you tell us about that day?
It's a day where my children were happy, planning their future. Because in our life, we have priorities. And the priority in our life is our future. But who is the future? Our children. I was discussing with them, where can we go, as I got two offers. One from the University of Toronto and one from the University of Harvard. So my daughter, Aya, God bless her soul, she said, we have to fly. And everything was ready to leave because those offers came before the war. And at the same time, I was supposed to be interviewed live by an Israeli TV. Seconds after I left my daughter's room, the first shell came. I didn't believe it. Because during that time, during the, what do I call, a human craziness of killing, in a time a human life is the most precious. Saving one, you save the world. Killing one, you kill the world. The world was witnessing, watching what is happening in Gaza, and they didn't do anything to stop it. It can be stopped. It can be prevented. And Gazans became numbers, statistics. They are not a human being with faces, with names. After I left my daughter's room, just seconds, the first shell came. I don't want anyone to see or witness or experience what did I experience. Where is Bisan? Those are beautiful, bright, lovely daughters. Bisan, who was 20 years old, who was the sister, the friend, the mother for her siblings. Bisan was the first girl that I can write books about her wisdom. Children, and I can tell people to take the wisdom and to learn and to listen to their children. In my life, I listened and I adopt the advices of my children, my daughters. Bisan was the first to send to peace camps at the age of 14 as a girl. Bisan is the one who said, in our life we face difficulties. As students, we think academic exams are the most difficult part in life. After she lost her mother, she said, it's life exams. Academic exams are the easiest in life. Where is Bisan? Where is Mayar? Who was 15? Who was the president of the students' parliament? Where is Aya? Who planned to be a journalist or a lawyer to be the voice of other children? Where is Noor? They became parts. Decapitated. As if they were born in a pool of blood. But I said, it's important to have faith. Said, this tragedy is for good. it must be invested for good. To disclose the secret and to save others. Why I was saved? If I stayed 5 seconds, I would be gone. And I will be added to the numbers. And my daughters as hundreds, even thousands. It came to disclose the secret and to open the eyes of the international community, the Israeli public, everywhere. It satisfied me the second day when was announced unilateral ceasefire. After the Israeli prime minister saw what happened and announced it, it saved others' lives.
So many people will listen to your story, though, and say, it's remarkable that your initial reaction would be not one of hatred, because in this, not just this war, but in this long-running war between the Palestinians and the Israelis, hate seems to fuel so very, very much. How can you set that aside, given not just what happened to your family, but what you saw with your own eyes? How do you set that hate aside?
We are human beings. And when God created us and blessed us to be human beings, that we have choices to use our minds. This is the difference between a human being and animals. I understand the people who adopt hate as their approach. But we have to think, to give ourselves the time to think, is it the right approach? I lost my daughters. They were killed with bullets. And if I wanted to hate, do you think the one I hate, is he thinking of me? And to hate whom? He's not thinking of me. Am I going to be destroyed to add more to the tragedy by injecting myself with hate and poison and fire that I will be wasted and consumed with? I lost my daughters, but I feel the responsibility. What can I do to keep them alive, living? Because I see my daughters talking to me. Do something. Our lives, our souls, our blood must be kept holy and noble, with good words, with wisdom. And good words and wisdom don't need hate.
How do you convince others, though, because so many other fathers have lost daughters in these conflicts, so many other mothers have lost sons, how do you convince them if they are filled with hate and they want to lash out or blame someone else? When you talk to others who've suffered what you've suffered, what do you say to them?
I talk to them. Just think for a second, for a minute. Remember the beloved ones you lost. What can you do for them? When one day you will meet them, what are you going to tell them? I stayed drowning in hate, busy with revenge? Or am I going to meet with them, proud, even every day to send them gifts, to send them messages of mercy, of good deeds in their memory? To send those messages, you must be wise. You must be rational, healthy. Because as long as you hate, your mind is shut down. You just focus. What can you do to get revenge of the perpetrator? And he is not thinking of you. You kill yourself. Self-destructive actions. Personally, as a believer, I believe I will meet my daughters. And I will meet them one day, as I swore to God and to them. I see them now, telling them, I kept your blood and souls holy and noble, and I am coming to meet you one day with the big gift, to bring them the justice with good deeds for them and others, and that their blood wasn't waste or futile.
When you hear talk about peace between Israelis and Palestinians, that means many different things to many different people. And here in America, when we talk about a peace process, it tends to be a political conversation about a two-state solution or political leaders getting together. What does peace in that region mean to you?
Peace for me, this political definition, what did you say? Political process, peace, how people can be safe, secure, free and happy. It's the well-being. And peace is not just and good for one. My peace is from your peace. Happiness is not with how much do I have. How much do I own? Happiness is with how much do I share with you? How much do I connect with you? It is outside. So peace is not internal. Peace is with connection with others. And that's what do I say? Peace will never be just and good for one. It must be just and good for all. By a choice, not by force.
But in this world where you say it's so true that you need to make a human connection with others, but in this place where high walls are built or where one political group wants to destroy, wipe the face off the face of the earth, the other group, it seems as though that connection, it's so very difficult to make. I'm wondering at what level you start to make that connection amongst people.
You can work at different levels. At the human level, at the people level, and the leaders level, each of them to take responsibility. And we must, when we speak about responsibility, not to generalize, to point by the finger, who is the obstacle? As you said, peace is a joint project. We need to build a bridge, not to build walls of separation. We need to smash those mental and physical barriers and to understand that our existence is linked together. My safety is from your safety. My security is from your security. My dignity is from your dignity. I can't be free as long as you are not free. We must get rid of the fear and to have the moral courage to work together and to admit the rights of all for the long term. Not the short term. Force can work. But for how long? Can we learn from the history that nothing by force can be achieved, even within the last few months, with what is happening in this world? In the Middle East, the weakest person is the one who carries the gun. The equation has changed. The civil people started to stand steadfast in front of the militarized people who are armed, equipped, and the other is the weak. The militarized, he can't shoot. He is the weak. The fear is inside him. The fear transferred from the people to the military people.
How does what has been happening in the Middle East, though, in the last several months, in Tunisia and in Egypt and in Libya and other places, how does that translate to the Palestinian experience, and can it translate to the conflict between Palestine and Israel?
It translates to the Palestinians and all over the world. I can say to you, we thought the nation and the people everywhere, they are dormant, and the leaders are working alone, disconnected from the people. It came, the nation to wake up and to say to their leaders, we are not asleep anymore. You are accountable to us, and we are watching you. It's a message to all leaders. It's time for the nation's role and to tell the leaders, you are there to serve us, to help us, to work for us. Your eyes must be focused on your nations, on the unemployed, the uninsured, the homeless, the students, the mothers, the children, not you, their eyes to be focused on the next election. We need leaders to tell them, you must take the risk, the challenge to work for us. Otherwise, see what happened for other leaders in this world. It will happen to you and to others. We can kick you out. That's the message for everyone in this world. And that's the other message, that nothing is impossible. No one would believe that. It's happening in 2 months. So everything is possible in life. Once there is a will, there is a way.
Dr. Izzeldin Aboulaish is an associate professor of medicine at the School of Public Health, the University of Toronto, and he's the author of I Shall Not Hate. It's a book that recounts his journey and efforts toward reconciliation between Israelis and Palestinians. He was in town last week to speak at Central Connecticut State University. Doctor, I thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Coming up, we'll talk to husband and wife journalists who moved to Jerusalem in 1999 and had optimistic plans to begin a family and witness a historic Middle East peace deal. They soon found themselves raising 2 daughters while covering the worst fighting ever between Israelis and Palestinians. We'll talk to them about their book, This Burning Land, that recounts their experiences of the changes taking place over the past decade. It's coming up where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. As we talk about the ongoing conflict between Israelis and Palestinians today, there are few journalists who've been closer to the action than Greg Myrie and Jennifer Griffin. They're a husband-wife team, Myrie a longtime reporter for The New York Times, Griffin a correspondent for Fox News. Their relationship started in South Africa and took them to many hotspots around the world, covering the news while maintaining a relationship and also finding babysitters for their kids. Their new book, This Burning Land, presents lessons from the front lines of the transformed Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Griffin now covers the Pentagon for Fox. Myrie is senior editor for NPR's Morning Edition. Welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you,
John.
First, before we get into the specifics of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that you both covered up close and that you write about in this book, I'd like to know what got you there in the first place. What drew you to cover conflict areas as a team? Maybe, Greg, I'll start with you.
Yeah, we started about 20 years ago. I was a young AP reporter sent to South Africa at a very dramatic time in the late 80s. And I met Jennifer, who was a college student taking a year off there. And we met at a massive rally in Soweto, South Africa, with 70, 80,000 people crammed into a soccer stadium to see some of Nelson Mandela's prison colleagues who'd been released. And we were immediately gripped by this kind of story. And this was an incredibly powerful story, and we look back on it. And I think having been at that place at that time, you couldn't help but get riveted and drawn in. And we just took it from there. We covered many conflicts in Africa, and then we went to South Asia and then the Middle East, and we were hooked.
In fact, John, when I first moved down to South Africa after graduating from college, Greg got assigned up to Mogadishu because there was a famine going on, and he left. I arrived on a Friday. He left on a Monday, and in those days, it was not easy to make. You know, there were no cell phones. You couldn't call. Greg was sent into Somalia with a manual typewriter, and I bought a one-way ticket up to Nairobi in order to follow him into Mogadishu, and there were only a few journalists in there at the time. I was negotiating with the drug dealers, the cot dealers, who were flying the drug called cot into Somalia. I was going to pay my weight in cot to get dropped off in Mogadishu because there was so much going on and there were no commercial flights. So I met Greg. I surprised him at the UNICEF compound in Mogadishu, and I called some newspapers from there, said I was there, and I started freelancing, and that's how I became a journalist.
Boy, I have to tell you, there's a certain part of romance that comes into this, but at the same time, Jennifer, it sounds a little bit crazy. Whenever you hear about people who decide they want to go into conflict areas, you think about these sort of death wish journalists who are adrenaline junkies. Meanwhile, you're trying to do this as a team, as a pair. Did you ever find this odd as you sat back and thought about the life that you got into?
Well, I, think we did. The key was we didn't take a moment to step back. We went from amazing human story, amazing being witnesses to history in different locations. We didn't step back and think. If we had, we might have reconsidered some of the places we went. But we were so compelled by the stories. We moved from South Africa to Pakistan. We witnessed the rise of the Taliban. Greg and I spent our honeymoon in Kabul. We had our two children in Israel when we lived in Israel for 7 years, and that's what the book is about, those 7 years in Jerusalem. But I would literally on some days when I was pregnant with the girls, you know, I would go to work with a flak jacket and a breast pump.
Yeah, I read that story in there, and I thought to myself, that's one of the stranger tales I've ever heard. Maybe you can tell that story about the flak jacket, the breast pump, and the checkpoint, and actually having to negotiate about a place to refrigerate your baby's meal.
Well, yes, it was, I think it was Amelia, our second daughter, and we were in Gaza, and I had always told my mom we weren't going to be in the same place where there was shooting at the exact same time, and that was our sort of rule as a couple. And this one particular time, we both got caught out. We were in the Gaza Strip, and we were crossing back through the Erez checkpoint, the point that where you cross from Gaza back into Israel, and there had been a suicide bombing in Jerusalem, and the Israelis shut down the checkpoint, and the sun was starting to fall. It was getting dark, and we realized we were going to both have to turn around and go back into Gaza. But we were waiting and waiting and waiting, and I had very carefully been, you know, bringing this breast milk for the baby who was back in Jerusalem, and I was, you know, I had gone down. I think I'd gone down to interview one of the leaders of Hamas, and I had to. At one point, I got so angry with the Israeli soldiers, the young soldiers who wouldn't let us pass through. I said, well, if you're going to keep us here, you're going to have to refrigerate this. And I put the milk on the counter, and you've never seen the look on their faces. But they knew I meant business at that point.
You know, when Jennifer talks about making promises never to both be in the same place in a shooting zone at the same time, I'm wondering, Greg, how that came into your thinking. What were some of the other types of negotiations that you had to do while you were literally raising two young children in Jerusalem and trying to cover all the violence around?
Yeah, I mean, that promise got broken pretty often. There were always contradictions that arose. I mean, we might both race out in the morning to cover the same event or different events, and at 1 o'clock we'd sort of be on the phone. Can you pick up the kids from preschool? No, I can't. Can you pick up the kids? And we'd be sort of going back and forth to see who would pick up the kids. There were occasions, one in particular, when it was a Saturday night and we just wanted to get some rest. And a suicide bombing just down the street from our house in Jerusalem rattled our windows, shook our house, woke our baby. Jennifer wants to race out the door to meet up with a camera crew to cover it. I'm trying to call the police to get details. And we're sort of passing this crying baby back and forth. Fortunately, our babysitter, who lived a mile away, was so well schooled in this terrible drill. She came racing over to our house. We couldn't even reach her on the phone, but she just knew to come running. So we made it work, but there was a lot of juggling going on.
The book is This Burning Land, Lessons from the Front Lines of the Transformed Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. The authors are Greg Myrie and Jennifer Griffin. They're a husband-wife team who've been covering the Middle East and really all over the world in conflict zones, and it's a fascinating look inside this world. You have two very, very different jobs working as a team. Greg, you're able to go into places with just a pen and a pad. Jennifer has to bring along a camera crew and an awful lot more. How was doing these two very different jobs different? What did you learn from each other when you're both trying to cover the same wars but doing two very different things?
Well, it was complementary, actually, in a lot of ways. I mean, I might be down in the Gaza Strip talking to some Hamas leaders, for example. Jennifer might be in Tel Aviv talking to Israeli military leaders. And we could compare notes at the end of the day and say, oh, wow, I didn't know that. Here's their thinking. Here's the way the Israeli military is approaching that. And I could tell her what the Hamas guys were thinking. So in that sense, it was often complementary. Many times we would just wind up at the same place. We wouldn't even necessarily be in contact, but just just running around doing our jobs, and we'd show up at the same spot, or we'd get home at the end of the day and say, you know, I spoke to these Israelis today or these Palestinians, and generally say, oh yeah, I spoke to them too. So,
well, in fact, John, there was there's an incredible story that we outline in one of the chapters of the book where I was down in the Gaza Strip, and the Israelis had carried out an airstrike, and they had killed a number of Palestinians, and the Israeli Greg was in Tel Aviv getting briefed at the IDF, basically the Ministry of Defense in Tel Aviv, about what had happened, and they were still denying that any civilians had been killed. But I was on the scene, and with my camera crew, able to see that in fact we had gone to the hospital, we'd seen, witnessed, and talked to those who had been injured, and saw that some had died in the airstrike. And what we did is we took the videotape of the nose cone video that the Ministry of Defense handed out down in Tel Aviv, and we took it back to our camera, to our editing studios in Jerusalem, and our bureau chief, Eli Fassman at the time, the Fox bureau chief, slowed down the footage. He had served in the military. He was a tank commander. He slowed it down, and he showed how the pilot had missed the people from the nose cone. But when you slowed it down, you could see that there was a stream of people running into the street at the time that the second bomb from the Israeli aircraft landed. So Greg ran over there. He was working for the New York Times, and Eli showed him the video. And so we worked in tandem a lot of times to kind of get to the bottom of stories, because we were basically, we doubled our vision on any given story because we were both out in the field.
Probably more than in any other conflict that you can cover in the world, the truth is so very, very hard to come by, because every time there is an attack into Gaza by the Israelis, there's always some sort of a statement that says that perhaps terrorists were there. Whenever Gazans lob some sort of missile into Israel, there's denials on the other side. How did you get at the truth of what was actually happening on a day-to-day basis? Because it must have been quite the moving target.
It really was on a couple levels. One great benefit of reporting from there is it was an open place. People loved to talk, and it was very, very small. So you could actually get to the scene. You weren't having to call 500 miles away by phone and try to find a witness. You could actually go to the scene, talk to eyewitnesses yourself, or in many cases, you would just be out and about, and stuff would be happening nearby.
But you could cross the front lines. That's what's unique about this conflict, is you could cross the front lines on any given day and report both sides of the story. And that's what this book does for the first time, I think, and why it's so significant in documenting the last 10 years, is that we were able to crisscross back and forth across the front lines, and we bring you characters from each side of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict so that you understand what each side is feeling and going through during this past 10 years of fighting.
And it's something, as you write in the book, you're lucky in that on neither side are either of these people going to likely say no comment. You're always getting comment from someone because, as Greg just said, people love to talk.
Yeah, yeah.
And journalists are also the vessels through which both sides present their case, and they're arguing their case every day in Israel and Palestine, and journalists are the vessels through which they do that, and we found that to be very fascinating. It's one of the reasons we stayed for 7 years, but also very difficult in terms of getting at the truth. And we have a chapter in the book called Versions of the Truth, and it's how even language is dissected in a way and crafted in a way to try and get you to each side's point of view.
Jennifer Griffin now covers the Pentagon for Fox. Greg Myrie is senior editor for NPR's Morning Edition. For 7 years, they lived in Jerusalem and covered the Israeli-Palestinian conflict there. They write about it in the book, This Burning Land. When we come back, we'll talk about whether there's a solution to this conflict that they covered for so long. It's coming up on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, prejudice is one of the more troubling and baffling aspects of the human condition. It's been the subject of scientific study for many years. Are we hardwired to judge others, or does our society teach us the us versus them mentality? A recent Yale study argues that prejudice is more than the product of our culture or history. In fact, we may learn something from our primate cousins. You can join the conversation on air and online at WNPR.org, keyword where. Today, Where We Live, we're talking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This weekend saw news about renewed pressure on Israel from the international community to make a deal with the Palestinians to create a separate Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. Greg Myrie and Jennifer Griffin thought that might be close to happening as far back as 1999 when they first moved to Jerusalem. They were raising their two young children while reporting on both sides of the conflict. Myrie for the New York Times, Griffin for Fox News. Their book, This Burning Land, presents lessons from the front lines of the transformed Israeli-Palestinian conflict. You suggest in the introduction to your book that when you moved to Jerusalem there to start a family and to live and cover this conflict, that you believe that perhaps you'd be there to see a historic peace agreement. Did you truly believe that, and at what point did you realize that that just was not going to happen?
Well, I mean, yes, I think we truly believed it was within reach. It was never certainly a certainty, but it just seemed like the Israelis and the Palestinians had put a half century of really bitter conflict and fighting behind them. You would see Israeli police and Palestinian police patrolling together in the same vehicle. Every day, 150,000 Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza came into Israel as commuters. They worked in all sorts of Israeli businesses during the day, went home at night. Israelis went to the West Bank to go shopping, get their car repaired, that sort of thing. There was a lot of interaction going on. We drove around ourselves. You often didn't know when you were leaving Israel and when you were entering the West Bank. We'd be asking, where is this conflict that everybody's been talking about? And the bitterness and the frustration and the anger was certainly there. But it seemed in some sense that a peace agreement would just begin to catch up with the reality on the ground, which was that the peoples were interacting and there had been no serious fighting for 3 or 4 years when we got there. So it certainly seemed possible. And I'll let Jennifer bring up the point when we realized it was all going to go bad.
Well, Greg, before you do that, mention one of the first days when you got there, the scene at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Dome of the Rock, what you witnessed at the mosque that day.
Sure. One of my first days in Jerusalem, it just is more mostly as a tourist, I started walking around, and I went to perhaps the most important piece of real estate there in the entire region, which is the Temple Mount, which is the most important place in Judaism. And it's also, to the Arabs, it's known as the Noble Sanctuary, that famous gold dome on the religious shrine there, which is one of the holiest sites in Islam. And when I walked inside the Noble Sanctuary, there were, of course, some Muslims sitting on the carpeted floor reading from the Quran. But the first thing I noticed were about 20 or so Israeli soldiers in uniform, but they'd left their guns and their boots outside, and they were sort of padding around the place getting a guided tour. And this is part of the sort of cultural sensitivity. Clearly the Israelis were preparing themselves for dealing with the situation there and looking toward the future. And the worshipers, the Muslim worshipers, were just ignoring this. This was part of the daily routine. It was not a big deal. It didn't feel tense. So there was this sense of, okay, we're trying to coexist and work this out. And it certainly seemed like it was moving in that direction. But within a year, things were very different.
And in fact, I was at the base of the Temple Mount, standing near the Western Wall, just beside the Golden Dome of the Rock, when Ariel Sharon, who was in the opposition leader, took those famous steps on the Temple Mount that really marked the beginning of 7 years of the Palestinian uprising. It was on September 28th, 2000, and I was pregnant with our first child, and I was feeling I had morning sickness, and I remember when the rocks started flying over the walls down onto the Western Wall where Jews were praying, and Ariel Sharon's visit that day. And we outline in the first chapter of the book what it was that motivated him to go there, and conversations that he had with certain individuals, and who it was who convinced him to go there. And this hasn't been reported before, but the person who did convince him to go has since died, and he had asked us to not tell the story until he had died.
As we talk about some of the ways in which all of this can change, I find it fascinating at the end of your book, you have conclusions in a series of 10 reasons why the both of you think that perhaps things have not gotten better. One of them has to do with the leadership on both sides, and maybe you can talk through that. You mentioned Sharon, but there are so many other leaders, powerful leaders over the course of time, who have not been able to, for one reason or another, get to the end of this conflict. Talk maybe, Greg, if you would, about how leadership, both on the Israeli and the Palestinian side, has been the cause or partly to blame for this conflict continuing.
Right. I mean, you had a lot of these sort of founding fathers on both sides. On the Israeli side, somebody like Ariel Sharon certainly stands out. And on the Palestinian side, the dominant figure was Yasser Arafat for decades. And these were men sort of born of the conflict. I mean, they literally came of age in every sense of the word back in when this conflict began in full in 1948. They were literally involved in the fighting in the 1948 war. And that I think colored their vision all the way for decades afterwards, and made it very, very difficult for them to make compromises and the kinds of things that were necessary for peace. And literally a half century later, in 2000, there you have Sharon and Arafat again at the center of this drama, and you had to. On the one hand, these were leaders of enormous stature. They could bring their societies along with them at certain key moments, as they had for many years. On the other hand, they were resistant to a lot of the compromises that would need to be made to work out an agreement. And so now what you see is you have, I think, leaders of much less standing. They're seen as politicians, and they don't have that stature and that standing. So on the one hand, you need a leader, I think, of great standing to make these very, very difficult, tough choices. On the other hand, those leaders aren't around anymore, and again, they may not have been willing to make those choices. So it's hard to see who exactly could lead either side to an agreement right now.
There are no Nelson Mandelas right now in the Middle East, and that was very disappointing to us.
But not just that there are no Nelson Mandelas. In a place like Gaza, it is filled with increasingly many, many young people who certainly don't remember 1948 or 1967. They know Gaza as one of the most tightly congested, most difficult, dangerous places in the world. And I'm wondering, Jennifer, how that plays into what we're seeing now, the rise of Hamas and their power, not only as a military, but as a political organization. It just seems as though, as things get worse in Gaza, it can't possibly make for a quick and easy resolution over the course of the next several years.
Absolutely, and it's really a cautionary tale for how problems cannot be left to fester in the Middle East. And you're seeing in these revolts that have the wave of revolts across countries, you've had decades where, like in Gaza, where there was not really a political outlet, there was not, and populations became radicalized. What's very interesting right now is for the first time in the Arab street in capitals across the Middle East, people are not blaming their problems on the Israelis and the Palestinians in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That used to be the old mantra in the Middle East. And for at least this short period of time, those revolutions are turning against the tyrants who ruled them and didn't provide them with services and didn't provide them. And so Greg has pointed out many times in recent days, as we've talked about this, that all it takes is a spark in the Middle East. There's been such a combustible situation that, you know, whether it was a fruit seller in Tunis who set himself on fire, you can't leave situations boiling for as long as leaders in that region have done, whether it's in Gaza or elsewhere, because the anger is such that it is really combustible.
But of course, the anger in some of these other places, in Libya and in Egypt, was against the tyrant, the ruler. It keeps coming back to the tyrant in the Palestinians' eyes, Greg Myrie, being Israel. And I'm wondering, first of all, if that will ever change. And as we were reading in the New York Times over the weekend, that the international community seemingly is ready to start to push Israel more toward doing something to settle this agreement on their own, to reach out to the Palestinians, because at a certain point, the UN and the rest of the international community is going to ask them to do this very, very thing.
Yeah, I think we're going to see something very significant coming up in the next few months. It will probably play out over a very long period of time. But for decades now, the paradigm has been Israelis and Palestinians should sit down and negotiate. The U.S. could often be the mediator. But that, and they need to work out an agreement. That's been the way this has been approached. But with the negotiations going nowhere, and literally for a decade now, we haven't seen any great progress, the Palestinians are starting to take a different approach, feeling, well, if the Israelis are not going to offer us something that we feel is satisfactory, and the Israelis feeling that we can't really negotiate because you've got a two-headed Palestinian leadership with Hamas in Gaza and the Fatah in the West Bank, we're going to just go for international support. And the Palestinians have, obviously, a lot of international support that there should be a state. And so they're talking about going to the United Nations, to the General Assembly, where the U.S. could not veto a resolution, and try to get recognized as a state of Palestine, which would include all of the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem. And therefore, Israel will be put in this very awkward position if something like that happened, that there would be a Palestinian state, except there would be Israeli civilians and Israeli troops in this Palestinian state. So instead of trying to negotiate a thousand small points with the Israelis, sort of going over their head and just going and making an appeal to the United Nations. And again, the Americans in particular vetoed a lot of resolutions against Israel over the years, but if something was done in the General Assembly, that would not be a place where the U.S. could veto it.
But also, John, go back to your point about tyrants in the Middle East, don't forget that the rise of Hamas in Gaza was as much a result of Yasser Arafat's tyrannical rule and the Palestinian Authority's lack of institution building and providing services to people. Hamas filled that gap, and that's what a lot of these Islamic movements have done in places. And so you really need to understand Hamas and the rise of Hamas in order to understand what's happening in a lot of the other Arab countries right now.
Before I let you both go, in our first segment on this program, we talked to a Palestinian man, Dr. Izzeldin Abolesh, who grew up amidst the violence of Gaza, and he saw his family ripped apart by it. Now, he's urging reconciliation. Do you think that there are enough voices like his on both sides of this conflict to actually make some sort of change? Because you do write about him in this book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he himself is the leading example. I'm sure as your listeners have heard the terrible, terrible tragedy that happened to him. And I actually met him back right around the beginning or shortly after the beginning of the Palestinian uprising in 2001. And he was just this remarkable figure even then. There are good people on both sides, like Dr. Abolesh, and even majorities, I believe, on both sides. But it can take a small number of people to undermine the good work. We saw this repeatedly during the 1990s when it seemed like the negotiations might be making some progress and there would be an attack or a bombing that would really sour the atmosphere and be a big setback. So, yes, there are enough good people there, no doubt about it. But it's preventing extremists from acting and destroying that atmosphere.
But, John, it's people like Izzeldin Abolesh. They are the reason that we wrote this book, because it's characters like them that we present in the book who we had such empathy for and we got to know in such a personal way over 7 years that we wanted people to understand the conflict through their eyes, and they became the vehicle through which we told this story.
Jennifer Griffin and Greg Myrie are the co-authors of This Burning Land, Lessons from the Front Lines of the Transformed Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. Jennifer, of course, is a correspondent for Fox News. Greg Myrie works for NPR's Morning Edition and was a longtime reporter for the New York Times. Thank you both so much, not only for the conversation, but for this great book. I think it teaches us a lot about what's been happening there over the course of the last several years. Good luck with it, and continued success to both of you.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
Where We Live is produced by Josie Holtzman. The senior producer is Katie Zalarski. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, The Evolutionary Roots of Prejudice. I hope you can join us.